Good morning, everyone. Thanks, David, for inviting me and for organizing this symposium. I have attended many ASH conferences, but never had the opportunity to talk about Citron, which is one of my favorites. In fact, I had about a 50 years on and off romance with Citrons, which pop up every once in a while from a different perspective. And what I share with you today is not exactly science, also some personal history, not only history of the Citron. It's very good that I had that we had Daphna Langwood's talk before mine. Because my talk is going to engulf what she said, both at a prehistoric earlier period and more recent centuries. And I hope that within the short or not so short time that we have, you'll get a good perspective on different aspects of the citron. So here is a picture of a citron, and which already shows some of the, for instance, you see here the very thick albedo, which is characteristic for the citron. You can also see that this fruit does not have a persistent style. You see here on the top, there are some of the citrons which have a persistent style. It means that I'll talk about that later, and you'll see it later. This is typical, one of the typical forms of a citron, just to show from a 1927 book on citrus. Now I want to point out few characteristics of the citron. A very thick albedo, narrow pulp, and I show it in the next. You see here, you have a comparison between a Yemenite citron and a mandarin. And you see that there is in this Yemenite cultivar of citron, you have no juice sacs whatsoever. You have just seed places, seed cavities. Whereas, and on the other hand, a very thick albedo, and by the way, the times or people who eat citrons, what they eat is the albedo. Contrary to that, you see in most other fruits, here's a mandarin, you see that the pulp and the juice vesicle occupy most of the volume of the fruit. Going back once more to the characteristics, it's monoembryonic, which means it does have the polyembryonic nature of some of the other citrus cultivars, which is important for various genetic and breeding purposes. It has apparently a self-fertilization system, so that it doesn't easily get contaminated by pollen from other sources. This can be shown, I don't have time to go into that, but it probably helped in preserving the nature of the citron throughout many regions and many different cultures. We find them very, very similar in many respects. There is the year-round blooming, which is also to some extent in the lemon, and you have a frost and root color rot sensitivity, which makes it very, very sensitive and therefore probably taken into grafting at a very early stage of the development of its culture. Now, I'm going to spend a few minutes on the evolution and domestication of the citron, and it's not only citron. Now, you all know that you have seen maps like that. This is taken from Chapeau in a booklet written in 1970 or so. And you see that the origin of the citrus is in Southeast Asia, with all kinds of controversial ideas, whether some come from China and some from Northeast India, from other regions. And while these theories have been outlined based on morphological features, we now have molecular evidence which can help us in portraying the early history of citrus in a much more scientific manner. And if we go back to the three ancestors paradigm, so beautifully introduced by Barrett and Rose in 1976, before there was any molecular biology around, we see that we have the citron, pomelo, and mandarin as three ancient ancestors. And this was in fact confirmed when molecular biology came into the picture, and I want to point out the work done in Sicily by the Sicilian group, Nicolosi and Tribulato, and we have here one of our lecturers who is in fact also part of that team, Professor Katara. And you can see here why the method, this work was in fact done in 1996 or so, and the methods were still not very refined, but you can see very interesting things. They compared about 17 genotypes and examined the markers, where they come from. And for instance, you can see that the lemon, which has 78 markers identified, now 45 of them were from the citron, and 31 were from the sour orange. So this was the clear evidence for what has been assumed many years ago, that lemon was not an original citrus species, but was some kind of a hybrid. How it exactly arose is still subject to some debate. Another interesting thing is you have a bergamot. The bergamot is a small orange-like fruit growing in Italy. Bergamot is in Italy, and it has a persistent style. So it was suspected many years ago that it was some kind of a hybrid with a citron. And you see indeed that from the 66 markers, there are 28 from the citron and 37 from the sour orange. So this study really confirmed that it's a hybrid between sour orange and citron. And here you have a picture of the bergamot, and you see the fruit, here the fruit, little orange with a persistent style, and we talk about that more in the following. Now, in recent years, there was some extraordinary work done on the molecular roots of citrus, and here is a paper appeared in 2014, last year, where almost every famous citrus scientist signed about on it. You have, I don't want to name all the 50 authors which appeared here, but you can see that you have geneticists and molecular biologists. Sequencing of diverse mandarin, pomelo, and orange genomes reveals complex history of admixture during citrus domestication, which in fact demonstrates the problem we have. You see, citrus proved to be much more complicated than, say, apple or so. In apple, the history following Vavilov and what has been done afterwards leaves us with quite a clear picture about the origin of our apple. The problem with citrus seems to be much more complex. But this study didn't go into the citron and this type of fruit, but a more recent study appeared this year, 2015, a phylogenetic analysis of 34 chloroplast genomes elucidates the relationship between wild and domestic species within the genus Citrus. This work was done in Spain. It very interesting from the point of my interest in citrons, as you will see. I'm not going to analyze and to report, give you a full account of this report, just to point a few interesting things. Here you see a dendrogram, and what you see here is that they had four different citrons: Corsica citron, Macvue mountain citron, Buddha hand citron, and Hampang citron. Only one of those was from the Mediterranean. And where do they cluster most closely? They cluster with the Australian desert lime, finger lime, and this group is originated in Australia. Thus, this study by Carbonell supports a notion raised by Mabberley, who is one of the people who does some evolutionary work on citrus, who suspects that the origin of citrus is not confined to the Southeast Asia, but should be go down into Australia and maybe even the Pacific. And the relationship between citrons and the Australian species makes it plausible that this is really maybe one of the evolutionary traits of the citron. Now, another interesting thing is that you can find an extreme similarity between all the different citrons. And here is an example. You see here, this is the genome of citrons, the two in the bottom, and the ones in the top are other types of citrons. And the citrons have in their chloroplast genome a very specific deletion of, I think, 279 bases. Exactly the same deletion appears in all the different types of citron. And if you see the next slide, which is of a more recent study by Goren and Klein, unpublished, you can see here, not in the chloroplast genome, but in the nuclear genome, again, a deletion, which is about, in this case, only about 12 bases. Ordang, Rami, Zax, Morocco, Assad, Buddha hand, Taimani, Greece, all of them had exactly the same deletion. So the citrons are very, very well preserved and very similar in spite of their morphological differences. This is something we don't really understand, but it's a fact. You see, this is a Buddha hand citron, and morphologically it's so different. So you would expect that genetically it would be also be different, but it is not. So apparently there is enough space between the genes and their expression in reality to allow a tremendous variability in morphological traits. And while the genetic basis, the DNA, is very, very similar. And here is maybe almost the last part of this section. You see here, this, I don't explain everything which is in this graph, but you see here, he talks about a farming cultivation of about 3,000 years as in an evolutionary time scale, 400,000 years approximately of the development of the citron clade. Now, I think this demonstrates what we don't know about how much human intervention contributed to the present appearance of citrus species and cultivars. Now, somewhere just appeared the chance seedlings. You know, there's a story that the clementine appeared in Algiers in the monastery as a chance seedling, just as a grapefruit appeared in Barbados first as a chance seedling. But has been there a specific breeding strategies or efforts to try and form new citrus, how much did man contribute to the present variability? This is a question, I think, which is not easy to answer. So, certain things may happen many, many years ago, and some may happen during the past thousand years or even less than that, in places like Italy, where there was so much interaction between different types of citrus and new cultivars and new species coming up. And with that, I'm going to move to another part, cultural aspects. I'm going to talk about briefly about two things which are characteristic of the Jewish use of the citron for the Feast of Tabernacles. And one is the persistent style, and I'm going to start with the verse in the Bible which Daphna quoted before. In Leviticus, on the first day of Tabernacles, you are to take choice fruit from the trees, later identified as citrons, and palm fronds, leafy branches, myrtle, and poplar, and rejoice before the Lord your God for 7 days. Now, this here is an example of an ordinary citron about 13 centimeters long, and here you can see very clearly the persistent style. Now, this from Ferrarius from 1646 without a persistent style. But here in Volkhammer, you can see a persistent style in one of the many citrons he had in his book. And it's so interesting that while nowadays citrons do not play an important role in any kind of a citrus book or in a kind of citrus collection, in the Middle Ages and in the Renaissance, they played a tremendous role. I think in Ferrarius' book, about a third of the book is devoted to all kinds of citrons. And in Italy, they were grown by the dukes and princes, and since it was cold, they were grown in orangeries, the ancient glass houses, which were the forerunners of our plastic and protected crop industry. This is a Yemenite citron. This cultivar has very, very large fruit. This is about 13 inches long and weighs about 6 pounds and has no style whatsoever. So I mean, it never leaves its style. What is the style persistence? Here, if you have a flower, this is the stiller, the style, and here is the ovary, which is going to develop into the fruit. Then the fruit develops, and usually the style falls off. Now, here you can see that it's just a simple fall off or abscission process. Here you see this is in the flower, and then you get a beginning of an abscission layer. You can see it here, then it drops, and you usually get a fruit in all citrus fruit, but not only citrus. I mean, in tomatoes and apples, it actually also occurs just the same. And now comes the surprising thing. In 1970, one day, we were just trying to prevent a June drop in oranges, and we were spraying all kinds of synthetic auxins. And come and behold, we find that the Valencia oranges have persistent styles. So this struck me immediately as an opportunity to do something about citrons, where people were so anxious and so ready to pay more for a persistent style. And so, this lemon, it goes with all of them, somehow this is one of the auxin compounds called picloram or tordon. It has a structure which can be reminiscent of 2,4-D to some extent. This is the only chemical which does the work. Don't ask me why, because nobody has ever done a biochemical study to see which enzyme is specifically blocked by this chemical which prevents the fall off of the style. Anyway, by this chemical at the time, 1970, we were not aware of patents or anything of patenting. We just gave it over to the growers, and since then it's very easy to get citrons with a persistent style in Israel or United States or everywhere else. And now the last part of my talk, the grafted citron enigma. I need to explain something about that. Here you have an example of a grafted citron tree. You see here the citrons, and here there's the outgrowth of the rootstock with some other fruit. Now, being that the citron fruit is used in a worship, by the way, here, this is a figure from Volkhammer showing that the grafting of citron was very, very common in the 16th, 17th, 18th century, and in the gardens of the, in the orangeries, they were doing a lot of grafting. So Jews didn't want to use those grafted citrons. We'll try and understand why. Grafted citron, halachic considerations. We are saying halachic. Halachic is the word, a Jewish word for describing the law, the Jewish law. Has the Jewish law something to say about the grafting of citron? Whether does it render the fruit fit or unfit for the use in the worship? Is it legally fit? Do we have reliable identification marks? Now, this is so important because you must understand the fruit were grown around the Mediterranean, but they were imported into the places where big communities of Jews were in Northern Europe, Germany, Poland, and there were special routes of transfer, and there are a lot of historical evidence about how the trade and taxing of this commercial business went. And the people who were, say, in Vienna or Frankfurt or Warsaw or Prague wondered whether they could trust that the citrons were not grafted, because, as I explained, people were very suspicious that the grafting is not appropriate to be used. A fruit from a grafted tree would not be fit for the use of tabernacles. Now, the last question is, which would really seem strange, may seed or cuttings from a grafted tree be used as a propagation material? Now, why not? We consider grafting as something which takes effect when it's in action. But once you remove it to another tree, why should there be an effect? But you should remember that there was not a good awareness of what genetics means. There was not an understanding that there is a difference between a physiological effect or between a genetic effect. And therefore, in fact, there was without even knowing the exact reason, there was a general tendency to declare that the grafted fruit were not, would say, not kosher, were not fit for use. And so they began a search on how can we assure that the ones we are purchasing or getting from a long distance, how to be sure that they are not grafted. Here you see, for instance, this coast of the Mediterranean near San Remo, which is just on the border between Italy and France, was a central area for the growing and trade of citrons during the 15th century, 17th, 18th century, and a very a historian called Schwarzkopf went into the archives of Sanremo and discovered a very detailed description of the trade of the citron in those areas. And as I explain you, this was cast a shadow on the whole thing of the citrons. This is what I call the grafting enigma. And in the article which was written by Janik and a few other people and myself, you can see that the history of grafting was full of debate and uncertainties about what grafting really does and what kind of mysteries of grafting. And on one hand, there were the mysteries of grafting, and on the other hand, I think just to be on the safe side, the Jewish rabbis decided that one should try to avoid using grafted citrons. And this initiated a search for the authentic citron, which I described in a paper written in 2005, how in fact not only the Muslims, but the Jews played a very, very important role, because everywhere they went, they probably took fruit with them and tried to plant etrogim, citrons, to have them for their use. And in that study, we examined the genetic background of 12 different types from Morocco, Yemen, Corsica, Italy. They all seem to be extremely similar. And here I don't have time to go into the details. There was a simple genetic analysis done in 2000, and nowadays something much more sophisticated could be done, and I understand Dr. Klein is working on that, but the results are not still available. Here there's something interesting, that these two are the Chazon Ish types, and these have certain difference than the other cultivars. And all the 12 things clustered into three different, in the dendrogram, three different clusters. You have the Diamante and the Calabria on one hand, the Taimani here, the Yemen, and the Morocco in another one, and the types in Israel called Chazon Ish and Kibilevich on a third cluster. And this, I think, is somewhat supported by more recent data, unpublished data by Goren and Klein. And with that, I'm going to finish. And this last slide shows something, that according to one tradition, the citron was the fruit of Eden. And in an ancient manuscript from the 14th century, you see Adam and Eve holding a citron and trying to overcome the lure by the serpent, who tries to persuade them and apparently succeeded to eat the forbidden fruit. So the citron has a lot of significance and a lot of background. And with that, I'm going to finish the talk and thanking the organizers and to all the colleagues that over the years contribute to this work, and to you for listening.
There's time for a couple questions. Dr. Sober?
We have an unusual concentration of scholars regarding the history of horticulture in this room, and it occurs to me that this skepticism about grafted fruit may be the first instance of human concern about intervention in the production of food. And a related question, was there also concern about actually consuming grafted fruit? And I'm suggesting that this possibly may be the first instance of what is now viewed or manifest as skepticism about genetically modified materials. So, your thoughts?
Never thought of that. That's amazing.
It's an interesting suggestion. I'm going to explore it further.
But was there skepticism about eating grafted fruit as well as using them in ceremonial purposes? And is there still some thread of skepticism about GM within certain Orthodox communities?
Yes, well, the whole thing, why citrons or citrus in general was so valued and appreciated, is not easily understandable, except that it's one something which started in Persia and continued, that every duke and king in Europe believed that he had to have a garden with exotic plants. And for centuries, citrus were maybe the best example of an exotic fruit, which apparently every prince and duke would like to show that he has them and that he can grow them, and that's all part of the culture.
One more question.
When did the persistent style become so important to Orthodox Jews? They pay so much more for persistent style.
Yes. Look, this is an interesting question also in the archaeological type. And here I'm kind of penetrating into the Daphna's area. Because in the archaeological remnants, we don't always see a style. And in the relevant text in the Talmud, it's not absolutely clear whether there is a requirement for style. So, and in the Middle Ages, say 14th century, the very significant authorities say that doesn't have to be a style. If there is a style, okay, but if it falls off naturally, it's not a problem. So it's not a necessity in that sense, and still it's a very peculiar and characteristic thing for a citrus fruit, which in fact no other main citrus species has. So I think that we don't understand all about it still, but the archaeological evidence is not so clear as to its significance, because you would expect that if it would be very significant, so on every mosaic you will see it. But in some of the mosaics, you definitely don't see it. So apparently not everybody thought that it was that critical to have it.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Okay.